Blog Talk Radio.
Incarcerated Lives Matter. The mission statement for Incarcerated Lives Matter is a movement to support and encourage the exchange of written communication between citizens, including groups and organizations, and millions of incarcerated Americans. And just a little bit about Valerie Shaw. This phenomenal woman has a background in journalism, having reported for a number of publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the Los Angeles Sentinel, and Wave Publications. She is a public relations specialist, having earned her master's degree in public relations from the University of Southern California. She is a founding member of the Black Public Relations Society Incorporated, and she was recently honored by the Los Angeles City Council for being the mother of the Black Journalists Association of Southern California, founded in 1981. Tribe Family Channel is a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand in partnership with Incarcerated Lives Matter. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Ms. Valerie Shaw and Mr. Stefan Ho.
What an introduction. What an introduction, Stefan. This is going to be a lot of fun.
It is. I'm very happy to be on the show. Thank you for having
me. And I'm very happy to meet you. I'm reaching out and giving you a hug over the air because your work is absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your kind words.
Are we talking with you from Denmark?
Yes, we are. While you're still having a beautiful day ahead of you, it is close to midnight in Denmark right now. It's always a very strange thought that you're still having your day ahead of you while my neighbors have already gone to sleep.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much for giving us your sleep time. And we are very, very grateful for that here in the States. And we're also very grateful, sir, for your interest in our situations, your interest in the Ku Klux Klan, your interest in the American dream, and now your consummate interest in the plight of death row inmates, and especially those who have been exonerated. I thank you, and I salute you for that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
How long did it take you to investigate the work that you just did with the deprived?
I started out in 2014. So roughly I've been working concentrated for 4 years on the book. What you can see in a book like this, that's all the research that you do just for the background. And when you get into the writing process, you interview a lot of people. You might even start out writing their stories. And then as you go along, you find out that there's nothing wrong with their stories, but they just don't fit in with the overall concept of a book like this. And when you put 10 different fates into a book, at times you also realize that that you have to deduct some of them because they're actually too similar to other ones that are included in the book. And to me, it was very important that I didn't write 10 stories that seemed alike. I wanted to describe this matter and society problem by putting different angles into each story. So it has taken quite some years getting this book done. But personally, I am very, very happy with the result of it. And the best thing, if I may say, about the book, in my opinion, is that before it was launched and even put into printing, I sent out the stories to all of the people participating because it was very important for me naturally to get their approval before it became public. Naturally, because it's their stories. But when you're writing about, for instance, a lady who had her 7-year-old daughter abducted and killed by a serial killer, then it is really, really important that she...
This is
Marietta Jagger.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it was so important for me that she and all the other ones signed off on the book before it became public. And what makes me so happy about that process is that it has been well received among all of the participants. And that makes me sleep good at night because as a journalist and an author, the last thing I want to do is actually tell people stories in a way where they either can relate to them afterwards or where they actually regret having participated. But in this matter, all of them have been really happy about the book, and that makes me even happier. So it's been a long process.
What I loved about the book was that it was not just... by the way, everyone get your pens out. It is available on Amazon and all of the booksellers' sellers. It's called The Deprived Innocent on Death Row. But it is not just about people who have been exonerated. It's the story of victims. It's the story of loved ones. I was very, very touched by Randy Gardner's story, watching his brother face the firing squad. So this is a story that touches every aspect of the system.
It is. And that is one of the things that has been really important to me. Actually put in a book out that touch bases on the most elementary or the most important things related to the death penalty and wrongful convictions. And therefore, I felt that I also had to do interviews with the relatives of people who had been executed. And I put one of them in the book, the one that you're mentioning about Randy Gardner. And to me, I was actually surprised. Now I would say I should have realized way earlier, but I was very surprised by how deeply relatives are affected by people, both, you know, just general in prison, but naturally also when the loved ones have become executed. And Randy's story is a very crucial example of how families become collateral damage of the death penalty.
Let me interject with just one afterthought on the Randy story. I thought it was compelling that he found it in his heart to still say thank you to the warden who allowed him to hug his brother. And it had been, 13, 14 years since his brother had touched anyone in the family. That made me cry.
Yeah. And as Randy says in the book, he believes that when a lot of these wardens, they retire, they will actually come out speaking against the death penalty. And there are also other stories in the book. For instance, the one about Derek Jameson, who was wrongfully put on Ohio death row. When the prison guards came to convey the sad message of his mother's death to him, they also comfort him. And to me, that's a beautiful story in the way that it portrays that even among people who have been given the job of executing other people.
Yes, yes.
You can still find something that has nothing to do in the first place with being against or for the death penalty. You find basic human emotions. And that is one of the things that I also want to portray through the book, that this is not only about the end result, it's also about all the things leading up to both a wrongful conviction, but also worst case scenario, an execution.
Yes.
There's a lot of things, emotions, processes, etc., till you reach that end result. And if we take that into consideration, all that's going on along the way, that's probably where we'll also find the answers to whether we, as a person, are against or for the death penalty, but also where we find the answers to actually change this wrongful thing, at least in my opinion, executing your own citizens.
Speaking of your own citizens, how many other Western countries have the death penalty besides America?
Well, I cannot really mention anyone that I would describe as a Western country. When you look at statistics and you have to measure, as an example, the countries in the world that carries out the most executions and put the most people on death row, well, sorry to say, but you'll have to compare America to countries like Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and so on. Not really countries that you normally compare the U.S. To when it concerns all other kinds of matters. You're not, when dealing with capital punishment, measuring the U.S. up against, for instance, Germany, England, France, Denmark.
Give Americans pause to know that we are that our rationale for the death penalty falls in the category of totalitarian regimes. I mean, we're supposed to be a democracy, so that doesn't fly with me.
No, and neither does it fly with me. But I think this has to do with, you know, you mentioned a democracy, but I would say this has to do with something called human values. In the Western world, America, Europe, etc., we always try to convey our values to other parts of the world. And
yes,
I must say, in many ways, rightfully, because we have beautiful values in many ways. But when it comes to this aspect of the American society, I think that executing your own citizens, that's not a value you can be happy about.
Proud of.
It's not,
yes,
a value that you by no means can try to export to other countries or other democracies. So Americans should take, and pardon me saying, but a good hard look at themselves and asking, can we in 2019 still kill our own citizens? When I express that opinion, people, they often mistake it for being soft on crime. I'm not. I do believe that if you do the crime, you should do the time. I believe that if you are a criminal and you represent a danger to other people, then naturally you should be incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of being executed, I'm a believer in counseling, education, and trying to actually make these people that we put in jail and prisons become better people. Because we all have an interest in that. We do not want to put people in prison that actually turns out to be even worse when they're released than when they went in. And therefore, yes, if you do the crime, you should do the time, and you should have a lot of counseling and education in prison so you don't repeat the crime that already put you in prison in the first place. So being against the death penalty does not mean that you necessarily have a soft approach to crime.
To crime.
Just have,
uh-huh.
Yeah. You just have, in my opinion, a more modern and humane outlook on whether we as people and society can be the judges of life and death.
I was also reading that in Texas, you talk about, there are three times, it's three times more expensive to put someone to death than for them to be in jail for 40 years. So that's just an economic advantage for not in, invoking the death penalty. Hello?
In spend 2.3, yes.
I'm losing you, Mr. Howe.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
I'm here. Yes,
okay.
I can hear you fine.
Me too.
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me as well? Yeah.
I can hear you.
That in Texas they spend, good. In Texas they spend $2.3 million on each death penalty case. And as you said,
$2.3 million
on each death penalty case. And as you said, that's three times the cost of imprisoning a person in a single cell at the highest security level for 40 years. And there are numerous studies that show that the death penalty is just a much more expensive way of punishing people. And furthermore, we have also to remember that a lot of the people put on death row, they're both innocent, but also the ones that are guilty, they do not end their days being executed, but by natural means of age and so on. So you actually spend a lot of money imprisoning a person on death row when he could be among popular or actually spend these 40 years in a single cell. By so many means, using the death penalty just does not make sense. And the best argument for abolishing the death penalty, that's the 164 persons who have already been exonerated from death row in America.
How many?
164.
Wow.
That's how many people that has been put on death row later proven innocent. And let's take into consideration that these 164 citizens, those are the ones who've been lucky enough to so far prove their innocence.
And how many more are there?
Exactly. Nobody knows how many Americans are spending each and every single day on death row for something they never did. And in a worst case scenario, they'll end up losing their lives on death row. And we have also, as described in my book, already examples of innocent Americans who have been executed. In my book, I have a story telling about the fate of Sonny Jacobs. She was convicted and put on death row together with her husband, Jesse, for the crime of killing two policemen in Florida before she was proven innocent. They executed her husband. When she was proven innocent, he was as well. And he's just one example of an innocent American who has lost his life on death row for something he never did. And when you talk about innocent people in prison, no matter whether they're serving 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, or the rest of their life, then we're talking about innocent mothers and fathers, innocent sons and daughters. Leaving their home in the morning, not doing anything wrong for the entire day, but by the end of the night, they're incarcerated in a cell for something they never did. And I think that when you put that down, plain and simple, in the way that we're talking about mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, then I hope that people, they realize what a big problem this is with innocent people in prisons. But also that it gives a face to these people. We're not talking about criminals.
Yes.
We're not talking
right.
We're not talking about hardcore bikers or anything like that. We're talking about mothers and fathers that are not coming home
I love
to see
that.
Their kids.
I love that you humanize them, that you don't call them inmates or prisoners. You call them humans, mothers, fathers, and so many, as you're saying, it's more than 164. It's thousands that are innocent. And I'm also following in the book about how easy it is to get a conviction if you are black or brown or an underrepresented part of the population and you don't have the money. What are you going to do?
Well, as many things in the American society, race plays a huge part as well when coming to wrongful convictions.
Do you think that's why the problem is ignored? Is because it is largely a minority problem?
No, because wrongful convictions, that's not only a minority problem. There's a lot of white Americans as well being incarcerated for things they've never done. And the sad thing is that if you are African-American, you're more likely to go on death row and you're more likely to go to prison for crimes you've never committed. But if I was a white American, I wouldn't lean back and say, we do not need to deal with this problem because I'll never be the victim of it. No, the truth is, you're not as likely as other races, but with the magnitude of wrongful convictions in America, you could go to prison for something you never did as well. And
it is a universal problem. It is not a race problem. It is not a class problem. It is a universal problem that we as Americans are not facing as being a part of our American DNA that probably needs a transfusion.
Correct, correct. In general, I would say that the justice system should be under review in America, or at least you should have also a political debate about the way that America uses prisons. Because Americans represent 5% of the world population. Still, you incarcerate 25% of all prisoners in the world. Why is that? How can it be that so many Americans go to prisons sooner or later in life than Germans, Italians, Danes, and so on? There's just something that does not add up in this way. And if you at the same time have this well-documented huge problem with wrongful convictions, well, in my world, that makes all alarms go off, saying, we need to do something about this.
Do you think that your book will make a difference with people who are not, because I was reading a couple of reviews that spoke to your book being eye-opening for people involved in the system. Do you think that this book can attract an audience with people who are not directly involved with the criminal justice system? Because I feel it's a book everyone should read.
Well, I agree with you on that. As the author, I must say, I think that everyone should read it as well. But I'm afraid I'm not going to be that lucky. But yes, I do believe that first and foremost, this book has an interest to people as well who's not involved with the justice system, because this is a problem that concerns everyone. As I said, with the magnitude of the problem, everyone, the American society, has an interest in changing what's going on.
Telling the story from different points of view. So that, to me, that makes it all the more compelling. It's not just formerly incarcerated citizens, but it's the families, the people on the inside. I mean, it just offers a lot of insight into the entire process.
Yeah, and I think there's one place where this book can really make a difference. And I hope it makes all the way there. And that's to the classroom of high schools,
yes,
law schools, and so on. In my opinion, if I was a teacher, I would make sure that my students would get a copy of this book. First of all, because it is saying something extremely important about the American society. Secondly, it is a book that really can help generate a debate about what's going on. And
yes.
Thirdly, this book, when you're having the debate, it can also change the public view on the death penalty in America. Right now, there's like 55% of all Americans in favor of the death penalty. That's a number that has dropped from like 80% just a few decades ago. So we're moving in the right directions. But I am sure that it's just a matter of a few years before the death penalty will be abolished in America. And the ones that's going to do it and actually say, this is enough, that's the generations that are, for the time being, starting to become lawyers, etc. Or the students in high schools. And I believe that
That's the importance of what you're saying, is for high school, for high school students and college students to read this. By the way, the book, again, is The Deprived Innocent on Death Row, and it's a fantastic, fantastic look at the American system. And we're talking to the author, Mr. Stephen Howe, who is talking to us from Denmark, where it is already midnight. So we're very, very grateful for Mr. Howe to be talking to us this late, and he sounds more alert than I do, and it's only 2:00 here.
I had a huge cup of coffee before I came on the show, so I guess I won't be sleeping for the next 2-3 hours. So no worries.
Okay.
I'm very happy to keep you up. Yes,
but
you do. Yes, you do.
Another word on the book. I want to mention to our audience that the book is frank. It is definitely frank. It is direct, but it is an easy read. It is a compelling read. I don't want anyone to pick it up late at night because it will give you nightmares, promise. But if you read it in the daytime, in the clear of day, read it with a prayer in your heart for all of the subjects that are discussed or that are giving their personal stories in the deprived innocent on death row. It is a compelling, compelling read, and I am so grateful for the opportunity of being able to speak to you about this, your second book. I wanted to ask you briefly, and then I want to get back to The Deprived, but I wanted to ask you about A Dream Derailed, your first book, and that was about the American dream, but it was printed only in Danish?
That's correct. That was a big mistake. I should actually have written it back then in when it came out in 2015 in English. But first, I started out writing it to and for myself because I've been traveling in America for 25 years. And I saw how the American society was changing. I had always been very impressed with how easily Americans were united. It didn't matter what religion you believed in, or if you came to America from Denmark, Mexico, or a third country. That was the experience that I had when I started traveling in America in the beginning of the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I could just see how things were changing. And
in front of
me. In front of me, with at least 7-8 trips I made every year to the U.S. And I spent all combined months every year in America. Some of my best friends are Americans and so on. So, you know, it was right in front of me that I saw the society changing. So I wanted to investigate with my first book if there was still such a thing as the American dream, or if it had become a nightmare to many people. And I did that by describing 10 challenges that Americans and the American society was facing. Not 10 challenges that I came up with myself, but I looked into surveys saying Americans believe, as an example, that illegal immigration, social inequality, racism, and so on represents the biggest challenges to our society. And the book contains 46 different stories of Americans that I have interviewed. One would be a illegal immigrant living in America. And putting focus on illegal immigration. When talking about or writing about racism, I looked up, as an example, a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan to find out why he was so full of hate towards other races. Mm-hmm. When I wrote about the educational system, I interviewed a young lady, I would almost say a girl. She was 21 years old. She was from Los Angeles, but I met her in Las Vegas, where she was working for a year. She was not working there cleaning hotel rooms or tending a bar or as a waitress or a nurse or anything like that. She was there working as a prostitute, getting enough money together to go back to LA and continue her education, her university studies. So that was the way that I went about describing the American society in my first book. And if people should ask, why do you, as a Dane, have the nerve to write about America and the problems that we're facing? Well, the honest answer would be out of love for America, because Americans are the most friendly, kind, loving people. We have
so sweet.
Much in common, Danes and Americans. If you came to Denmark, I think you would be surprised. If you asked 100 Danes how they feel about Americans, 99 would say that you're our closest ally. We respect you deeply and dearly, and we see you as our friends. And that goes for a lot of countries. I would say most of the countries in Europe. So it is out of admiration and love for America that I also feel that I need to put my perspective and view on these problems into a book, because we all want America to thrive. America
is
important to the entire world. And numerous times, America has helped Europe again and again and again. God forbid, but who knows if we might need the help of Americans again. But
and who knows? And who knows when America is going to need the help of our European partners and allies again? I don't think we realize that as America. I don't think that we really have an appreciation of our. We realize our position on the world stage, but we don't understand that the stage is occupied by many actors. We kind of have a isolationism. A la Hoover and before World War One, we just have an attitude about Americanism. You know what I mean? We don't embrace the mores and the cultures of other civilized nations, like what you're talking about, the death penalty. We are the only civilized nation that does impose the death penalty. I wanted to ask you another question about that. Do you think that the criminal justice reform that is now lighting up America, do you think that that might have any impact on these indeterminate and harsh sentences and death penalties?
I think that the biggest influence will be the voice the Americans live in through this problem or this potential problem. One thing is politics, but one thing is for sure. By the end of the day, politicians, they always listen to their voters because it's the and it's the voters that decides whether they have a job or not. So let's continue where we were a bit earlier, talking about younger generations.
Have you thought of using the subjects in your book, the people that you talk to, have you thought about putting them on camera and making a documentary on them because their stories are so riveting?
Yes, I have. And that is also one of the things that I'm looking into. Right now, the most important thing for me is actually raising awareness about this book, because writing a book, putting it out publicly, no matter if it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on, you still have to make it visible to the readers in competition with thousands and thousands and thousands of other books. So I think this book has a really important message that Americans should hear and listen, not for my sake, for their own sake, and not least for the innocent people in prison. And if people want to close their eye or deny this being a problem, well, one thing you should realize is that you might end up having the problem in the way that you could be the next one to go wrongfully convicted to prison. So if you can actually raise a debate through a book like this, then the easiest thing would also afterwards be putting these stories into a documentary movie, which could reach a new and another crowd than the ones reading
yes.
the book. So yes, I'm very interested in that. I'm also very interested in doing a podcast about these 10 chapters in the book and giving each of the chapters a episode. Because I want to also
I love
in that,
that
way.
Idea.
Yeah. And I can tell that we're already looking into it, because I want to cover each and every possible angle. Also from a media perspective, I want it on print through the book. I want to make this message accessible to people who want to digest it through a podcast. And I want the magnitude of a documentary.
That visual aspect.
Yeah. Yeah, because that can, you know, that can reach a completely different crowd,
demographic.
But right now, I want the Americans to become familiar with this book, and realizing that it exists and it portrays the wrongful convictions through different perspectives and through different angles. Because, you know,
the
more
deprived,
you know from this.
The deprived innocent on death row, that is our subject for today. That is our, we are highlighting. The author is Stephen Howe, and he's a Danish author who has a love for we Americans. And that is why he dedicated this monumental work to us and for us, that we might improve our condition in all respects, not just criminal justice, but it affects every aspect of our lives, education, sociology, our demographics, everything. And so I just want to congratulate you again and again and again and praise you as a fellow journalist. I am so proud of the work that you are doing in this regard. I wanted to ask you, Stephen, where did you find this eclectic group of people? I mean, it's not a group, they're individuals. How did you find them?
Through hours and hours and hours of research. But there was one certain man that inspired me to do the book. And it was while I was working on my first book, as we spoke about, where I also looked into Injustice for the Law. And back then I interviewed a man called Nick Yaris. He spent 22 years on death row in Pennsylvania. And I met with him at a posh restaurant in Los Angeles. A few years after he had been exonerated, or actually more or less 10 years after. But we met in this restaurant, and I was sitting there waiting for him to arrive, and I knew very little of him. So I was wondering if a man would step into the restaurant crawling along the walls because he had been broken from all these years on death row, or if I would meet a man as hardened and brutal as the system had been towards him. But I found something in between, in the way that he was not broken. Yes, in some ways, you will be broken after 22 years on death row. But he was not cruel. He had not given up on life and other people. So I met this very kind, loving, and very, very well-educated persons. And he inspired me to do the book in the way that when I had put his chapter in my first book in Danish, I decided, or I was actually curious, does it just go for him that he can still offer people the love and the kindness that society couldn't offer him when he was wrongfully convicted? And when he was put in jail, beaten and bruised by prison guards, stabbed by other inmates, being the witness of 11 people losing their lives in prison, either to suicide by the hands of being killed by other inmates. So I wanted to investigate if this was something that other exonerees also managed to offer other people, love and kindness. And one of the most positive findings in my book and through all these interviews, that is that the exonerees are among the kindest persons I've ever met. Yes, many of them are bitter, but they're not bitter towards other people. They're bitter towards the system that put them on death row. But I am so gladly surprised by the fact that they have a lot of affection, good thoughts, etc., for other people. And my conclusion is that they have seen so much cruelty in their lives that as free men, as having regained their freedom, they've decided that the life they have, that should be fully lived and have value, then they should become the complete opposite of what the system was to them. And therefore, I don't see any revenge, bitterness, or anything like that, or the lust for revenge within these people. And it's just a beautiful story that you can do a lot of cool things to people, and yet they come out on the other side, showing, as mentioned, the love and kindness to other people that they couldn't show them when they were put in prison.
Now, how about you had a couple of inmates or a couple of exonerees whose family did not forgive them, or who still looked at them as if they were criminals. Do they harbor any resentment towards family members?
No, not to my knowledge. I believe that most of them, they have naturally been deeply hurt by both family members and friends, believing that even after exonerated, they were still guilty of the crimes that in the first place put them on death row. But there might be different explanations to why that is. Imagine if you had a brother that was on death row for 22 years, and you see how much hurt and harm he does to your family through these 22 years, in the way that a mother or father or sister or brother are being viewed as the relatives of a brutal murder. And therefore you decide that the only way that you can cope with this is actually by becoming as hateful towards your own brother as the surrounding society. And then all of a sudden, you're told, the brother that you hated for putting your family in this position for 22 years was actually never guilty of the crime that he was convicted for. How would you react then? Well, a lot would probably feel ashamed of themselves.
Yes.
But
yes.
In many aspects of life, it takes more to say, please forgive me,
right.
than
right.
to go on believing in the hate that has gotten you through these 22 years, and therefore continuing to believe that your brother or your sister was actually guilty of the crimes. And there's also other stories that I've come across where the exonerated has lost a lot of friendships because it has also been difficult for friends to actually come actually realizing that they were wrong as well while friends mm-hmm. were on death row. At other times, I have interviewed innocent people that decided afterwards, out of a good heart, not to contact family members that had expressed during their prison sentence that they believed their own brother or father to be guilty of the crimes, simply because they did not want to rip up this wound and having to face relatives saying, for a number of years, you actually publicly expressed that you believed that I was guilty. Well, here
right.
you have me back. I'm not. Is there anything you want to say to me? So, you know, that conversation is something, or confrontation is something that they have actually, on behalf of family members, wanted to avoid. And I admire that as well. Because, you know, working on a book like this, reading a book like this, you'll probably ask yourself a lot of questions. So let's say that it was me who had been wrongfully convicted and put on death row for decades. And I knew that close family members had in public denounced me as a person. Well, to begin with, I would probably, you know, as a free man, feel like we need to have a chat about this. But these exonerees that I've spoken to, they have been clever enough, kind enough, good-hearted enough to make sure that they would not put relatives in that position. And I admire them for that.
It's a beautiful thing. Whether I could be so brave and so confident that I could make it on my own, and I know that there's family out there. That's a very difficult thing, to give up your life and just to move on, especially after being incarcerated for decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how do you rebuild your life?
Well, unfortunately, to many exonerees, it's difficult rebuilding your life. Remember that not only towards how you surround yourself with other people. First, in the first place, just getting out of death row after decades. Mm. Well, you'll need to learn how to use a cell phone. You'll have to find out how you actually make that money transfer through your online bank. Though, you know, banal stuff that we
do. Well, first of all, you've got to have a bank.
You've got to have a bank.
But
the problem is, that a lot of the people that are being exonerated, they do not have a bank. And
yes.
they do not have anything to put in it, because they went to prison while they had their best working years ahead of them.
Yes.
The working years that would get them a house, that would get them a car, that would make sure that they had a retirement plan. Then perhaps they leave prison 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old. Now as free men, but also as very poor men, that has to not only struggle with financial issues, but also issues like how do we cope in a modern society that is so different than the one that we were taken away from 20, 30, 40 years ago. And then again, they also have to reestablish trust in fellow man. So if you're wrongfully convicted and on death row, but now a free person, well, how do you react the first time you see a policeman walking down the street? How do you react the first time?
Let's hold that thought, Stefan, and forgive me in the engineering booth for cutting in, but I know you too will not lose that point right there. What I want to do is open up the lines and see if the callers would like to say something to the two of you. So let's go to the phone lines before we run out of time and lose you. Caller, area code 314, your line is open with Incarcerated Lives Matter with Valerie Shaw. Did you have a question or a comment?
Well, I got a comment. And, of course, you know, it's tragedy when people are serving time for something that they didn't do. And how they end up there. But also you have to look at the other side, the victim of those crimes. And I hear where there's going to be prisoners released from jail on the account that their crime was nonviolent. And I think that the victims on the other end should also have the ability to include input. Because the victim never thinks that the suspect or those that found guilty ever spends enough time to satisfy them for their loss, either monetarily in items
or
even human life. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you guys will agree with that. And another thing, too, I think that their resources, which is meager, should be applied on the end where the elementary children are to provide them with the resources, support, and necessary things for them to improve on their skills and education so that they don't end up in that proverbial pipeline that leads, as many people have said, to the prison system. What's your opinion on that?
Stefan, how about you? I totally agree with everything he said. I do have a couple of additional things to add, but Stefan, what's your point of view?
But I agree, and I think it's a really good time to bring in the victims as well, because you can bring it in on many different levels. But when you put innocent people in prison, there's a reason for it. It's often due to other people's cruelty when given a false testimony. But it's also because a lot of people experience bad lawyering in the way that their defense is not well prepared enough, or if the defense is actually, pardon me saying, too busy with everything else than their job. And it's also because there's a lot of people going to jail simply because law enforcement has not been good enough and having a high morale enough to conduct their job as they should. So coming back to the victims, when people, they go to jail without being guilty, that actually means that the guilty ones are still out there. So if you as a victim of a crime believe that the guy in jail also committed this crime towards my mother or father or whoever it may be, when he, she is found innocent, it opens their wounds again, because the ones that actually did the crime is still out there. And the victims, they have to go through the pain again and again and again that they might went through during trials 20 years earlier.
Yes.
So that's another important aspect of wrongful convictions.
I wanted to mention something, even if someone is correctly convicted in regard to victims, because I don't think many of us take this into consideration, is that when someone is handed down a sentence, it always includes restitution. Well, the restitution normally does not go to the victims, it goes to the state. When a person who is incarcerated, when their family members want to put money on their books, 55% of it goes to the state. It does not go to the victim, it goes to the state. Anything that they buy in the commissary, that money does not go to the victim, it goes to the state. So this is a way for the state to make money, money, money. Phone calls, commissary, clothes, anything that you send to a prison, you have to pay extra for that. And it's not just in postage, it's to pay for the state. And that is how the state makes revenue, whether the prison is private or the prison is public. So I'm all for the victims getting restitution. Oh, one other thing about restitution. It is set by the judge. So if somebody robs a liquor store and they get $1.25, but someone was moved in the process of them holding up that liquor store, they moved 1 inch, they are convicted of kidnapping and armed robbery or whatever it is. And that restitution is going to be maybe $500,000 because the judge had a bad day. It can be anything that the judge sets. And so, therefore, the system is rigged and it is not fair to the victims or to the perpetrator or the families of those who are incarcerated. Hello?
Yeah.
So are we on the same page?
Yes, we are.
Well, yeah,
yes, we are.
And I really appreciate your answer and also adding in the element of restitution, because that is a major part of when you commit a crime against somebody. You know, in many societies, that perpetrator has to make that family whole. And the sins
now
of the father.
That makes sense. How is that in Denmark, Stefan? How does that work in Denmark with restitution?
I would say that we have a completely different system than in the U.S. Both the way that we sentence people and with the way that people are getting education, counseling, etc. in prison, and also on the many different levels that society takes care of the victims afterwards and so on. And going into the differences would be a very long technical explanation, but one thing that I would like to outline with the difference between the U.S. system and the Danish system is, in general, the way that criminals and victims are being both seen and treated. By the end of the day, we know that we need to make sure that everyone actually comes out of these crimes as good as possible is. Not only the victims, but also the criminals. Because in Denmark, if you commit murder, you will probably be serving roughly 8 years. That's it. Then you're out. But the fallback rate of murderers is so unbelievable low that I think Americans would find it very hard to believe. And the reason why that is that when you are put in a prison in Denmark, you get a lot of counseling. you get a lot of education to make sure that society should not suffer the crimes you've already done once. So that also goes back with the victims again. If you are being the victim, directly or indirectly, of a crime, society has an interest in you moving on as good as possible is afterwards. So there's a lot of things to be taken into consideration when you measure the Danish law system up against the American. I do understand that a lot of people, and especially the victims, they have a need for revenge. I would have that myself. But instead of incarcerating a person in prison for 40 years, releasing him or she later on, and seeing them repeat the crimes that put them there in the first place, would you then rather give the person 10 years, but making sure that these 10 years are spent very well on counseling and educating these people to make sure they do not repeat the crimes that they already did once? And I think that's another thing that should be taken into consideration. How do you actually help both victims and the perpetrators through counseling?
Well, you know, I was going to add this too, that in some society, the crime of the father falls upon the child, the children. And in Denmark, it sounds like to me that you're expending a lot of money. First of all, that child, I don't know if you got a public school system. That person went through a public school system where they was provided with education and all the things that's supposed to go along with it. Then they come out and they commit this hideous crime. And then you're expected to educate them all over again. But that's Denmark. I live in the United States.
Yeah.
You guys have a nice day.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much for your call, caller, and you have a nice day as well.
That was great.
All right. Wonderful, wonderful.
I'm so anxious to hear more about the Danish system and to compare them. I hope that this is one of our first shows, but I hope that we're going to interview Mr. Stephen Hoff with The Deprived, The Innocent on Death Row, which is now out in, it is being published, it is published, and you can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all of the booksellers, and I do highly recommend it. It's a fantastic read, and it's an easy read. It is a compelling read, frank, direct, and quite brutal journalistic report, as one reviewer says. Hello.
I'm hoping that
indeed.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm hoping
okay,
that this is also just the first of many talks with you. These are important issues putting light on, without any doubt.
Your work is fantastic, sir. I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed. The name of the book again, The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row. Now out in, is it paperback, Stephen, or is it hardback? It's one of those in-between kind of books.
It's paperback.
It is considered a paperback, but it's really a nice glossy cover. It's very, very well done. So I congratulate you on that. I hope that we see it on the bestseller list. I hope to be catching you on MSNBC and some of the news programs that are especially interested in the criminal justice system and this issue of the exonerated on death row. Finally, I wanted to ask you, Stephen, are you working with the Innocent Project or any of the exoneration organizations in the States?
No, not directly. I have been working with them in the way that I have used them as sources. But I have not been working with them in any way as an affiliate or by them having any stake in the book or anything else. It's been important
to
me that
it would be nice to see in one of your editions, because I know it's going to go into a second, third, and fourth and fifth printing. It would not be nice to see a forward or a word from the Innocence Project, because what you're doing is extremely beneficial to these organizations that are trying to seek exoneration for so many people on death row.
Yeah, and I would love to. The thing is that with this book, after that it was published, I have actually reached out to all of these organizations, not only in the U.S., but also across the world, organizations working to free innocent people, to abolish the death penalty and so on.
Yes.
So I am trying to get this book as far out as possible. And naturally, I believe, and I would be as bold as to say, expect that a lot of these organizations also have an interest in promoting the book and putting light on it, because it's
absolutely
right down the core business of what they do. And understand me correctly, what I personally think is unique about this book is there's been written a lot of great books that I really admire about persons who've been on death row before, but often they tend to be focusing on one person's story.
Yes.
In
yes.
this book, we have 10 different stories, 10 different angles, 10 different ways to make sure that people, they get 360 degrees around this matter, this issue, this topic. And that's also why I believe it's such a good educational book, and why I think that the organizations working to help the innocent can also take, I would say, some kind of pride and use this book as a tool to enlighten the people who need to be enlightened in order to abolish the death penalty or to make the justice system better, so we avoid all these wrongful convictions.
Let's try to make that happen. I mean, like the word of mouth. There's nothing like the word of mouth, especially we Americans who are married to our cell phones and married to social media. I think that everyone listening to the show should reach out to the Innocence Project or any organizations that you know are working with exoneration issues, and contact them and tell them that they absolutely have to buy, The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row by Stephen Hull, H-O-U. How do you pronounce your last name, Stephen?
Just like you do, more or less.
Okay. It's so easy. It's easy to mess up. H-O-U. Okay.
But you do it very nicely. If there's something that I would like to add to the discussion about the organizations working to free the innocent.
To give out your website too, Stephen.
Yeah, but that is actually my name, StephenHou.com. On my website, people, they can read about why I became a journalist in the first place and the work that I do. But I would just like to add one comment, and that is when people, they both read the book, talk about the book, and so on, and just as you and I are doing right now, and if people, they spread the word of it, they not only help this book getting out there, more importantly, and I say it again, more importantly, they are giving They are giving the innocent a voice.
Yes.
If we could actually put this book, your show, documentaries, other books, newspaper articles, people giving speeches and so on, if we can bring them much more forward in the minds of people, then we're helping the people who are still in prison despite never having done anything wrong besides leaving their house in the morning so they could be convicted for being at the wrong place at the wrong time. So that is also why I am trying to do as many interviews as possible. That's why I've said I'll even go and meet high school classes with, if there's only 5 students in it. And, you know, I'll travel the states to the smallest places just to make sure that this important message of innocent mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, being in incarcerated for no good reason, that there's put focus on it, because I can't see many other things as cruel as depriving people of their justice, freedom, and naturally, worst case scenario, their children, and unfortunately, in some cases, their lives.
As an African American, I'm prayerful that our churches, who are so active in all of our social movements, that our African American churches will embrace you and embrace your message and become involved in this growing evolutionary movement to actually seek justice for justice's sake. So I'm hoping that that we have a large audience and that they will call up Pastor right away and tell him he needs to get this book.
Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome. It's my pleasure. Madam Producer.
All right. Wonderful. Are you calling for me?
Yes, ma'am. I want to know, are we going to have Mr. Stephan back again? Because he's fantastic.
I am so honored to report to our audience, Incarcerated Lives Matter will be back on April 6th at the same time, same tribe, family place, and also on May 4th. But it is at this time that we would like to know in the engineering booth if we should set the show a little earlier to accommodate Mr. Stephan's schedule, because since we're on the East Coast, or excuse me, since we're on the West Coast in California, both you and myself, Valerie, we can start like at 10, which would be 4 hours earlier, perhaps, and then that would put Mr. Ho at 8 p.m., maybe?
How does
that
sound for you, sir?
That sounds great, but
we want you to get some sleep.
Yeah, but I'll be happy to get out of bed any time of day to talk about this important matter. So as it suits you, I'm just happy to be on the show, and I'm happy to go back on the show these dates in April and May.
Wonderful. And in the meantime, I'm going to start doing some research, so when we come back on the air, I will have a report for you, sir, about the outreach that I've been able to do on behalf of the book, and at least to spread the word and to, create a little buzz around here.
That sounds great. I'm very, very happy and very grateful for that. And so will the innocent people. No matter if they are, you know, convicted 5 years or on death row, they will be grateful, I guess, as well, because they need a voice and they need focus on this cruelty to release them and bring them back to life where they belong.
Well, you're a great voice and a great advocate, and I'm glad that we have you. Not just they have you, but we have you, because we need voices like yours, and so many of us don't pay attention to these issues because we're so involved in our own daily lives. But thank you very much for your concern and for your involvement.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Awesome. And I want to thank you as well, Mr. Stephen Ho, for allowing us to have your support as the sponsor of the next three episodes, season three, episode 3, 4, and 5 of Incarcerated Lives Matter, founded by Ms. Valerie Shaw. Valerie, I would like for you to shout out your book and your email where people can get in touch with you if they have some questions and a follow-up to this show.
Okay. Well, my email or my website is, or my email is incarceratedlivesmatter@gmail.com, and my email is civilrezation@gmail.com, so you can get in touch with me either way. And of course, the name of the organization is Incarcerated Lives Matter. And Stephen, I have to get your address from Miss Beverly, because I want to send you one of our little promotions, which is Incarcerated Lives Matter little wristbands. So I want to send you a little supply of those so that you have
them.
That's
very kind of you.
And you can,
thank you,
you can give them out, and people will remember you as someone who is very, very active in the justice movement, and we're so grateful for that.
Thank you very much.
And then also, we want to let our listening audience know that Valerie Shaw is the author of Too Late for Time Out. Valerie, please let our audience know about the book and how they may purchase it.
Okay, Too Late for Time Out, you can get it on Amazon. It's a Kindle book, and it's a really easy read. And the idea for Too Late for Time Out is to help kids, help parents, stop their kids from pre-juvenile delinquency behavior before it is too late for time out. I write this book as a voice of experience. My son was involved with the juvenile justice system when he was just 14, and we're just coming out of it over a decade later. So I don't want parents to have to go through what I've been through. I want to save a lot of people a lot of grief, and Too Late for Time Out hopefully will do that and give you some warning signs, some resources, a lot of places to go, a lot of research to do. But it's all worth it, and I've cut it down to maybe a 2-3 hour read, and you will be up on the game and ahead of your kids when they're trying to play the game on you.
Mm-hmm. Amen, amen. Thank you both of you for your time and your energy on Incarcerated Lives Matter, founded by the lovely Ms. Valerie Shaw. We have been listening to her phenomenal guest, Mr. Stephen Ho. Stephen Ho is a Danish author and filmmaker who has worked all over the world and has written about topics such as child abduction, Ku Klux Klan, the white supremacy movement, human trafficking, and the death penalty. So thank you once again. You can catch the archives via our studio at blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. And we are, Trot Family Channel is a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand in partnership with Incarcerated Lives Matter. You can find us on Facebook, on Google Plus, and on Twitter at Tribe Family US. Valerie, Stephen. Wonderful show. We are going to go out. We will see you at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, April 6th, and again for the third installment at May 4th at 10 a.m. once again. Out of respect for Mr. Ho's time zone in Denmark, we're going to adjust the time for our next two episodes where he and Valerie will again break down their books and the lives that are being affected by mass incarceration and the innocent on death row. Thank you once again for listening, and have a blessed rest of your afternoon.
God bless you. And we are going to talk more about the Danish system, and we're going to talk about my progress with getting the word out.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to that.
God bless you, sir.
Thank you, likewise.
Just like a bird, I just want to fly free. And I own a piece of land somewhere off in a country. Listen. Temperatures like 100 degrees. Like I got chains for me. Blackmail in the family tree. Been proud of my destiny. Reckon I'll fly away. Cause it's too much for the man. Shouldn't have gone down this way. What happened to my master plan? Cause I can't figure out. I could have been a love child. Shouldn't have gone down this way. Tell me, how did I get lost? Oh, yeah. Talk to me. Oh, how did I get lost? Tell me, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Tri-Family Channel.